This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a community access media station. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.
Hello and welcome to Landwise, Promoting Sustainable Crop Production, a podcast series about sustainable ways to grow food in New Zealand. I'm Georgia O'Brien, Extension Coordinator for Landwise based in Hastings. Landwise has been around since 1999, helping farmers and growers to develop and test new practices through on-farm trials and extending cutting-edge research to the farm or orchard gate. Through our podcast series, we are bringing the insights of lead researchers, technologists, and farmers to listeners from all over the ag and hort industry. Each month has a theme, with guests joining us weekly for discussions. This month, we're covering part two of Managing Herbicide Resistance, brought to you by our platinum sponsors, BASF, Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Vegetables New Zealand, and Processed Vegetables New Zealand. I'm excited to be joined today by Professor Philip Hume, a leading international invasion biologist at the Bioprotection Research Centre at Lincoln University. His primary research focus is predicting the risks arising from plant invasions. Philip joins the podcast to discuss how him and his team are applying big data analysis to the emerging threat of herbicide resistance development in New Zealand weeds. Thanks for joining me today, Philip. It would be great to start with an introduction to what big data is and how you're using this as a tool to investigate herbicide resistance development.
Thanks, Georgia. Well, perhaps the first thing is to think about what small data is. So in herbicide resistant areas, what we tend to do is looking for herbicide resistance. We'll grow some plants up and spray them at different levels of herbicide to see at what level do they die and whether there's any resistance. So there you have a data set that's quite simple. You have the concentration of active ingredient and you have the number of plants that have survived or died at those different concentrations. So that would be a small data set. What we have is a much larger data set, which is effectively multiple different layers of data. So in our case, we're looking at 300 species of plants that have become herbicide resistant around the world. And for each of those species, we know out of probably about 80 countries, which countries the species has become resistant in and which ones haven't. So that's a large matrix, a large table with species and countries. So that's quite a large data set. But then you've got to think about that's just one layer. So we have several layers because we have that data for different types of herbicides. So you multiply those up. Each layer is a different herbicide. So for glyphosate, for example, we have a matrix showing which countries 300 species have become or haven't become herbicide resistant. And for another one and for another one. So you can see it's stacking up as to multiple layers. Now, that's fairly complex already. You've got a big sandwich of data sets that are sitting on top of each other. But in addition, we have when those species became herbicide resistant. So then you've got another dimension. You've got a dimension of time. So now the data set's kind of a three-dimensional data set getting quite complicated. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, what we're adding to that data set is information on the species attributes. So whether they have large seeds or small seeds, whether they are perennial or they're annual, or whether they are pollinated by wind or whether they're pollinated by insects. And so now the dimensionality of that data set becomes very complex. So we just call it n-dimensional. So it's more than three dimensions. It's several dimensions. Very hard to visualize.
Definitely.
But today with things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, you can actually extract the relevant information from that data set. And so you need fairly good computing power to do that. And historically, we've not had that capability. It would take days to run on a PC. Now we can actually run it very quickly with the faster machines, but also the better software to do that. So we can really interrogate the data set to say, how important is the time at which herbicide resistance occurred? And are there any patterns in terms of how earlier species became herbicide resistant in relation to the particular traits that species had? So we can really interrogate this data set in multiple different ways.
So if I could just go back a little bit, basically what you're saying is big data and your work is looking at collating all of the different trials and studies that have been going on with herbicide resistance and pulling them all together to try and interrogate, as you were saying, specific factors and find out new insights from this big group of data.
That's right. So, I mean, we're very lucky that someone else has been going around collecting all the published information on which species have had trials that have shown their level of herbicide resistance. So we're using a database that's been generated by other people. But on top of that, we're adding our own data sets in terms of the species traits, for example. But we're also adding economic factors for every country, because we also believe that the economics of a country might also determine the extent to which species might become herbicide resistant in that country.
Right. And how does that impact things?
The economics, well, you can imagine different regulations for herbicides, for example. The more strict the regulations for herbicide and the more monitoring by organizations like environmental protection agencies might mean that farmers have to comply much more with on-label instructions as to how to use the herbicide. Whereas in other countries, they might just base it on, you know, well, what shall I use today? I've got this herbicide, and so I'll spray that on. So it really depends on, you can imagine that depending on the level of agricultural development in different countries, the way that herbicides are being used, if they're used incorrectly, could facilitate greater herbicide resistance.
Right, so I guess that goes back to what Robin and Martin were talking about in terms of the drivers for herbicide use and what sort of information and pressures farmers have on them when they're making decisions.
That's right. And also, I mean, the other aspect is the cost of the herbicide itself. So, you know, we're a reasonably economically healthy country, but still, herbicides become quite an expensive product to use. Imagine that you're in Bolivia or Argentina, where perhaps, you know, your economy is not so strong. You might be diluting your herbicide just to make it go a bit further, in which case it's less effective, and so herbicide resistance might evolve much more quickly.
Right. So can you dive into some of those insights that you're uncovering so far about how, when you're pulling all of these factors together, what the machine learning and AI is bringing out?
Yeah, I can. I mean, the approach we've adopted is quite different from what other people have done in the past. So in the past, what people have done is say, here are all these weeds that are herbicide resistant. We'll look in the literature for species that have never been seen to be herbicide resistant and say, well, what's the difference between these weeds and the ones that are herbicide resistant? Now, we believe that that approach is flawed because you don't know which weeds in the future might become herbicide resistant. And also, you might choose species that have no possibility of ever becoming herbicide resistant. So it's not a very fair comparison, comparing species that there's never any record of herbicide resistant with those that have become herbicide resistant. What we're doing, we're taking the global pool of species that we know are herbicide resistant, but they're herbicide resistant at a global scale. In every country, they might occur, but sometimes they'll be herbicide resistant, and sometimes they won't be. So what we've done, we've taken one large region, one of the regions with the most herbicide resistant weeds, which is the United States of America. And for that large region, we have looked at all the weed species that have a history of herbicide resistance somewhere in the world. They're not all herbicide resistant in the USA. So we're able to take some of those species which are herbicide resistant in the USA and compare them with species that aren't herbicide resistant in the US but are herbicide resistant elsewhere. So they've got the potential to be herbicide resistant but haven't become yet in the US. That novel approach means that we're actually comparing the potential to become herbicide resistant, not some other factor which might be unknown in terms of herbicide resistant. All these species can become herbicide resistant. What is it that stopped them from becoming herbicide resistant in the US?
Right.
So that's the comparison we're making there.
So what's the risk profile then of in situ herbicide resistance development versus the introduction of herbicide resistant weeds from other regions or countries?
Yes. Yeah, so I think that the main driver has been in situ herbicide resistance in country rather than the movement of herbicide resistant weeds around the world. Herbicide resistance is a relatively recent phenomenon. Now, it's quite true that a lot of the weeds that we find in crops historically have been moved around as contaminants. But basically, most countries have implemented quite strict regulations in terms of the quality of seed they import for sowing in a country. And New Zealand's got some of the most strictest regulations possible. And while things like black grass might slip through, they are actually doing a pretty good job at stopping these weeds come through. So I think, for various reasons, there's a good border protection, but also even if things slip through, they slip through at relatively small numbers. The only exception I have with that is something such as herbicide-resistant ryegrass, where we might be importing huge numbers of seeds, and we can't distinguish them. They're not really seen as weeds as such. They're actually the crop. So in under those circumstances, you could actually import herbicide-resistant ryegrass because there's no systematic screening of herbicide resistance at the border. But you wouldn't necessarily introduce another weed species because they tend to be identified in the seed lots that come in, and then they're screened out. So my feeling is that most herbicide resistance occurring in the future is going to be in situ herbicide resistance due to changes in selection pressures from agricultural management.
Right. So that gives growers a lot of power then to actually control how much herbicide resistance development occurs, apart from ryegrass potentially, and that their practices are going to have the biggest impact on whether or not it develops.
True. I mean, but possibly all they'll be doing is slowing down the rate at
right.
which it develops. So that's the concern, is that these plants are very, I mean, weeds are very adaptable. So what you might simply do is slow down the rate. And what we've seen are the kinds of traits that allow these species to become herbicide resistant are quite logical. So they tend to outcross. That is, they tend to share, you know, breed with other individuals. They can't just self. So that means an opportunity for quite rapid gene exchange. So what that means is once you've got a herbicide-resistant plant in your field, it's outcrossing. So therefore, the genes for herbicide-resistant are likely to spread to other individuals of that population quite quickly. The other aspect is that they tend to be wind rather than insect pollinated. So again, pollen's likely to go much further under a wind pollinated system than under an insect pollinated system. So the spread of those genes is likely to be going much further across the landscape. So we can understand some of those traits. And I guess the other aspect is that there are clear things with the size of the genome. So the bigger the genome, the more opportunities there are for mutations to occur in that genome and allow the plant to become herbicide resistant. So all those aspects suggest that a lot of these plants are primed to become herbicide resistant. And it's not a matter of, you know, if, it's a matter of when they will become herbicide resistant. So
right.
You know, so I think that's the worry for farmers, is that this is an issue that they're not going to escape from very easily. They just need to plan for it in the long term.
Mm, definitely. And so what are some of those weed species that, as you say, have all of those characteristics that make resistance likely to develop, the outcrossing, wind pollination, and large genome?
Well, things like the pigweed, so amaranthus, which are quite problematic, particularly in the States, and we do have amaranthus species here. They're fast-growing, they have they're wind-pollinated, and they outcross quite a bit. So those would be some groups. Many of the grasses, of course, also outcross, so grass weeds are also a problem. So those would be two groups I would think that farmers probably need to be a bit more cautious about. And, you know, we can see that grass weeds are a particularly big problem in cereal fields.
Right, definitely. And so from all this work, from the study that you've been doing, what are you predicting will be more of a problem in the future, and what do farmers need to be thinking about now to limit that risk of herbicide resistance development?
Yeah, so our work's been entirely with the US data set, not because we've got any favors or being paid by the United States, just it's the largest data set we had at hand. And so we've made some predictions for the US, particularly regions in the US. So the issue there in the US is that some areas of the United States have weeds that are herbicide resistant, but that same weed is not herbicide resistant elsewhere in the US. And our suspicion is that those weeds will become herbicide resistant in other parts of the US simply because the conditions there will enable them to become herbicide resistant at some point in the future. So I think that's what we're seeing. So I'm sure most New Zealand farmers aren't too worried about what weeds American farmers are suffering, particularly because their agricultural regimes, you know, herbicide resistant crops, etc., is quite different from New Zealand. From a New Zealand perspective, what we want to do is to try and use these models to predict what might be the risks in New Zealand, and we've not yet done that. So I'd rather hold fire at this stage rather than send out warning signals that farmers should be looking at for particular weeds. We will be able to do this in a year or so, but not at the current time.
No, that's great. And I guess it's just the approach that's quite novel. Trying to identify the climatic, socioeconomic, and plant-specific factors that can potentially contribute to resistance development.
That's right. I think it's fascinating, and you know, I think that we benefit a great deal from a lot of the agricultural extension workers in the world who have actually quantified things like herbicide resistance, and you know, it's the lack of that information. And I think that one of the things about our the Managing Herbicide Resistant Project is that there's that component. There's that component of finding new information, but there's also the real importance of going out to farmers and finding out what their problems are. And I think that that's probably not been a strong aspect of herbicide resistance in New Zealand up to now. And I think the project will capture that kind of information and increase our knowledge of herbicide resistance in New Zealand. And we can then use that information in our models to make more refined predictions as to what risks we might face in the next 10 to 20 years.
Yes, exactly. And I guess, as many farmers will tell you, some weeds are less of a problem than others. You know, if you're looking at weeds that might cause a issue with crop acceptance in terms of the harvest, like nightshade and peas, then that's a lot more problematic than some other weeds that can be removed in other ways.
Yeah, you're quite right. But then people who have nightshade in orchards don't really care too much about nightshade. So, you know, the herbicide resistance in nightshade in orchards is less of a problem for them, but they could still be letting that herbicide resistance develop. And then it goes into pea fields, and then it's somebody else's problem. So I think the other issues that we're coming to terms with within the project is you can't view individual farms in isolation. You've got to look at the landscape dynamics of the spread of herbicide resistance, because you know, someone else's problem may not be your problem, and vice versa. And I think herbicide resistance might start in, you know, for example, in the management of field margins, and then it spreads into the field. So all that thinking has to be brought into managing these problems in the future.
Great. It sounds like a really integrated approach, and we will definitely be following your research to see what insights you come up with, both from the US data set and what predictions that could potentially mean for New Zealand farmers. So thank you very much, Philip.
Oh, great. Pleasure. Thank you.
The Landwise Promoting Sustainable Crop Production podcast series was brought to you by our sponsors. We appreciate the generous support from BASF, Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Vegetables New Zealand, and Processed Vegetables New Zealand.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a community access media station. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.